Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising. This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Valerie Sanderson, and in the early hours of Monday, June the 1st, these are our main stories. In the United States, more protests follow the death of a black man who died in police custody in Minnesota. Delivered, docked, and delighted.
Endeavour, this is Houston. Bob and Doug, welcome to the International Space Station. You've completed a historic ride to the ISS and have opened up a new chapter in human space exploration.
Two US astronauts on a privately funded rocket joined the International Space Station. Brazil records the world's fourth highest death toll from the coronavirus. Also in this podcast, one of classical music's most celebrated sopranos, Maddy Mesplé, has died at the age of 89. Can the United States avoid more scenes like this one? That's the sound of riot police trying to disperse crowds of protesters in Minneapolis in the state of Minnesota with tear gas and flash grenades on Saturday night. 5 days after an unarmed black man called George Floyd died in Minneapolis, it was one of around 75 cities across the country to be engulfed by protests. Anger swept across the US after Mr. Floyd was filmed gasping for his life while a white police officer knelt on his neck. One sacked officer will appear in court on Monday, charged with third-degree murder. Three other officers have also been sacked. On Sunday, the governor of Minnesota, the state in which Minneapolis lies, reflected on the role played by racism. At a news conference, Tim Walz said while his state had high levels of personal income and happiness, the past week's events had shown those statistics were more reflective of the white experience.
You cannot continue to say you're a great place to live if your neighbor, because of the color of their skin, doesn't have that same opportunity. And that will man itself in things that are the small hidden racisms. It'll manifest itself in a child of color not getting the same opportunities, or a black community not being able to acquire wealth through home ownership because of lending practices. And as we all said last week, the ultimate end of that type of behavior is the ability to believe that you can murder a black man in public and it is an unusual thing that murder charges were brought days later.
Governor Tim Walz. Back in 2016, there were 3 weeks of protests in Minnesota over the killing of a 32-year-old African-American man called Philando Castile. He was shot dead by a police officer in St. Paul during a traffic stop while he was reaching for his driving license. The officer was later acquitted. Since then, the Castile family has taken steps to try to improve relations between the community and the police force. Philando's uncle, Clarence Castile, even joined the St. Paul Police Department as a reserve officer. He's been talking to James Kumarasamy about his response to the death of George Floyd.
When I saw him on the ground with the police officer's knee in his throat and him saying, "I can't breathe," you know, the first thing I thought the cop was going to get off of him, but he didn't. And it's like the longer he laid on top of this guy's throat, the more my chest would tighten up. The horror just grew and grew and grew. And then I heard that George Floyd scream out "Mama" after he had said he couldn't breathe several times. It was like his last words were "Mama." Grown men don't call a mama unless they are in the grips of the most horrific moment, about to die. I mean, we were looking at this man lose his life, and I kind of felt my life draining out at the same time.
You had a physical reaction as well as an emotional one then.
Exactly, exactly. And it's like you hear people in the background screaming, "Get off of him, he can't breathe." And that cop didn't move. He didn't pay any attention to anyone.
Very different circumstances, of course, to the death of your nephew, but for your family, that must have brought back the memories.
The result was the same. Death, be it by gunshot, be it by asphyxiation, be it by the electrocution, whatever. I mean, death is death. You're gone. Your family doesn't have you anymore. Your friends don't get to see you anymore. No one gets to see your face or hear your voice. You're gone.
And now we have had days of protests, initially peaceful, but there's been a lot of anger and a lot of violence, really, as well. What do you make of what has transpired in the last few days?
Well, a great man once said, riot and protests are the voice of the unheard.
Martin Luther King.
That's right. And we are in a season of riot. And that was created by a winter of delay, a delay of justice, humanity, and equality.
So when the National Security Advisor said today that there are just a few bad apples in the police force, most of them are heroes, is that what you recognize as well?
Me, myself, I say every cop has good intentions on being a good police officer when they join the force, but we are all human and we make mistakes. The thing is, when a person makes a mistake, they need to be held accountable for the mistake they made. But most of the time, when the cops make a mistake, or when we as citizens believe that a mistake has been made, cops never admit that they make mistakes. They are always right. And in our eyes, we don't see them as always being right because we're not biased. We are as honest as we can be with what we know. We need to, you know, do things to bridge the gap with trust. And if we can share information, learn how to work together in our communities and learn to trust one another, then we can build on that.
Clarence Castile in conversation with James Kumarasamy. The Dragon has been well-trained 19 hours after the SpaceX Falcon 9 rocket blasted off from the Kennedy Space Center. Its Dragon capsule docked smoothly and automatically with the International Space Station.
Dragon, SpaceX, docking sequence is complete.
Dragon, arriving. Crew of Expedition 63 is honored to welcome Dragon and the Commercial Crew Program to welcome aboard the International Space Station. Bob and Doug, glad to have you as part of the crew. Well done. Bravo Zulu.
The first mission in 9 years to send astronauts into orbit from U.S. soil had successfully delivered its two-man crew. Notably, the rocket was built by Elon Musk's SpaceX and not NASA itself. Steve Swanson has flown two space shuttle flights and one Soyuz flight, all to the International Space Station, of which he was a commander. He's delighted to see American astronauts back in space.
It's hard to be a leader in space when you don't have a crewed vehicle to take you up to space. So that's a really good thing to have back again. I'm very happy with that. And I think it is actually a plus to have a commercial entity working along with NASA. I mean, I'll have to admit, I was at NASA for many years, and NASA is a large bureaucratic organization, and it has some great people and does some great things, but it is also very slow and doesn't move quickly. And so having a young company come in that has energy and can get things done very quickly, and that combination to me is a great working relationship, and that's how come we got this all done.
Our science correspondent, Jonathan Amos, says the International Space Station seems almost like a throwback to the days of closer international collaboration.
The space station is remarkable in many respects. I mean, you look down at planet Earth and you think, my goodness, it's a mess down there occasionally, you know. But up there, they do seem to be able to pull things together. You've got the Russians working hand in hand with the Americans, and then you have the other partners in there too. So, you know, Europe, Japan and Canada all throwing in their best knowledge, their hardware, trying to make this laboratory in the sky work. But of course, they need means to get up and down to the space station. And for the last 9 years, we've been relying on the Russians totally with their Soyuz rockets and capsules. Well, now we have an alternative with the SpaceX system that was brought forward by Elon Musk, the tech billionaire, but there are others coming too. So we'll have a multitude of capsules and rockets very shortly.
Now, these two American astronauts have arrived. What will they be doing with the other astronauts?
Well, they have to muck in, basically. Yes, they're doing this sort of test of this new capsule, putting it through its paces, checking it's all A-OK and reporting back to the engineers at SpaceX. But in the meantime, they join the existing crew on the station. So they have to do all of the maintenance and science tasks that any crew on the space station does. It was quite funny, actually. Chris Cassidy, who is the current commander of the space station, said, you've arrived on the Sunday, and that means you've missed the Saturday. And of course, Saturday on the space station is cleaning day. Everybody gets out their the equivalent of their feather dusters and their cloths, and they clean the space station down from top to bottom. Well, they missed that, and Chris Cassidy said, don't worry, we'll have plenty of cleaning for you next weekend.
Mm-hmm. Jonathan Amos. Sunday marked a significant moment for both Muslims and Christians. Two of the holiest sites in Islam reopened their doors after more than 2 months shut down because of the coronavirus. And for Roman Catholics, Pope Francis made his first public appearance before a crowd in St. Peter's Square for weeks. Siobhan Leahy has been following developments.
For the first time since March the 15th, around 700 worshippers attended dawn prayers at Al-Aqsa Mosque in Jerusalem, the third holiest site of Islam. It's an important day for what's been a somber couple of months for Jerusalem's Muslims, who've marked both Ramadan and Eid without being able to attend their mosque. Inside, worship looked a little different. Face masks were required, and people were ordered to bring their own personal prayer rugs. One worshipper at Al-Aqsa, Mustafa Abu Swai, said reopening the doors to the faithful was a great relief.
It is a joyful day that people are allowed back into Al-Aqsa Mosque. And since the numbers, the spread subsided and the numbers are very, very low here, the Waqf Council decided to reopen Al-Aqsa Mosque, taking into consideration all the health measures that are required. The congregation left the mosque, and this is why I removed my own mask at this stage.
There were similar scenes in Saudi Arabia as hundreds of people streamed into the Prophet's mosque in the city of Medina. The mosque was one of around 90,000 in the kingdom that are reopening, albeit with strict regulations in place. Elderly people, children under 15 and those with chronic diseases are banned from praying at mosques. People have to do ablution, the cleaning ritual, at their homes. And over in Europe, it's been a significant day for Roman Catholics. For the first time in 3 months, Pope Francis delivered a noon address from his window overlooking St. Peter's Square in the Vatican. In a message departing from a prepared script, he cautioned against rushing to relax restrictions imposed to contain the spread of the coronavirus and said that healing people was more important than saving the economy. But whilst the Basilica may have reopened to the public, the faithful still are not permitted to attend masses led by the Pope for fear of crowding. Here in Britain, allowing congregations to attend their place of worship is a bone of contention. The head of the Catholic Church in England and Wales, Cardinal Vincent Nicholls, has said it looks like the government's putting business before religion in the way it's easing the lockdown.
What has been quite provocative, actually, to me, is the thought that on the 15th of June on Victoria Street, people can go and browse around the bookshop, but on the other side of the road, the doors of Westminster Cathedral will remain locked. I can see no consistency there. And it feels to many people of faith that the importance and the contribution of faith to individual lives, to family lives and to society is either not understood or is being marginalised.
The COVID-19 pandemic has hugely impacted the lives of religious people around the world, many uncertain about when normal worshipping might resume.
Siobhan Leahy. And now to Brazil, where the number of coronavirus deaths has risen by almost 1,000 in a single day, making the country's overall death toll the fourth highest in the world. Its latest figure of more than 28,000 deaths is now higher than France. Almost 500,000 cases have been recorded, the second highest figure in the world. No one knows how many have gone unrecorded. And if that wasn't enough... There have been protests in Sao Paulo and Rio de Janeiro. Police fired tear gas at anti-government protesters who are demanding the resignation or impeachment of President Jair Bolsonaro. Our correspondent in Sao Paulo, Katie Watson, told me more, starting with the latest on the coronavirus figures.
Saturday night showed that nearly 500,000 cases here now, confirmed infections in Brazil. It rose by a record amount, 33,000 cases in 24 hours. But also the number of deaths rose nearly 1,000 up to 28,834. So that means that now the death toll in Brazil has overtaken that of France.
And Katie, President Jair Bolsonaro, he's consistently played down the outbreak of coronavirus, hasn't he? Do you think these latest figures might change his mind, change his stance on the pandemic?
I think we saw on Sunday once again what has become a bit of a weekly ritual, Jair Bolsonaro coming out, talking to hundreds of supporters in the capital, no attempt at social distancing. Once again, a display of defiance, really, from a man who has called coronavirus the sniffles in the past. So I don't think he's going to be changing his stance, anytime soon. He has made very clear what he feels about it. He wants Brazil to get back up and running. He wants the economy working again. He wants Brazilians back to work because he says they're the ones who are going to suffer from a continued shutdown. But, of course, this comes at a time when the death toll keeps rising, infections are growing at an ever faster rate. It's a pandemic that Brazil is struggling to control.
And what about the protests? What can you tell us about those?
So we saw... Most weeks we see Jair Bolsonaro supporters coming out calling for military intervention and enter the Supreme Court. Tensions have been rising between the government and the judiciary. A judge published a video a week or so ago, which is part of a probe into political interference by Jair Bolsonaro. And this week we saw the president accuse the top court of censorship because they're looking at allegations of fake news and intimidation among his supporters. So we saw on the streets, we saw Jair Bolsonaro's supporters on the streets of Sao Paulo. And at the same time, we also saw groups of rival football teams marching for democracy and against the president. And clashes broke out. Riot police threw tear gas and dispersed the protesters. We're talking not huge numbers because this is in the middle of a pandemic. A lot of groups stayed away. Nevertheless, showing this unrest on the streets and this continuing political crisis at a time when Brazil needs to be focused on a pandemic is increasingly concerning.
Katie Watson. And still to come in this edition...
They can play with their friends, so they can a little bit forget about the sad times.
What it's been like going back to school after lockdown for the Netherlands' youngest children. China's new national security law for Hong Kong has led to an increasing number of people looking for a way out of the territory. There's been growing criticism from abroad as well. Taiwan has already indicated it's prepared to help, and the former colonial power Britain says it might consider allowing Hong Kong residents to come to the UK for an extended period of time if they hold British national overseas documents, known as BNO passports. Here's the Foreign Secretary, Dominic Raab.
If China follows through with this national security legislation, we will give those people who hold BNO passports the right to come to the UK. We'll lift that six-month restriction. We'll allow them to come to the UK to live, to apply, to study and work for extendable 12-month periods, and that will provide a path to citizenship.
I asked our defence and diplomatic correspondent Jonathan Marcus what that could mean in practice.
Well, that's very hard to say. Obviously, how many people of those eligible to come to Britain would decide to come here? How many would want to extend their stay beyond the new period, which is a year? And how many of them might want to further take up this point that Mr. Raab mentioned of providing a pathway to future British citizenship is very difficult to say.
But we are talking about possibly hundreds of thousands of people from Hong Kong coming here to Britain and indeed to Taiwan.
you're right, the potential is there. Taiwan, of course, has also said that it's willing to assist people who wanted to leave Hong Kong. That, of course, gets us into a whole other ball game, which is the tensions between Beijing and Taiwan.
And I suppose the Chinese calculation is, would the UK and indeed Taiwan follow through?
Well, I think the key point is, you know, how much global pressure can be brought against China in a concerted way. We've heard from the British, we've heard from the Americans, we've heard obviously from a much smaller player like Taiwan. It's interesting, while Europe has expressed its grave concern about what's going on, the EU still wants to pursue dialogue with China. There's no indication that the EU is thinking about, for example, sanctions against Beijing and so on. China may just believe that there is sufficient chink between the countries of the Western alliance, that it can perhaps take this risk and make the gamble and succeed. I think the great danger in all of this, and the danger that could lead to significant miscalculation on one side or the other, is that you have multiple crises all kind of merging now. The China-Hong Kong tensions, the China-Taiwan tensions, Mr. Trump's antipathy towards much of what China is doing. You have obviously his own domestic electoral considerations. You have the distraction, as I say, of the pandemic. You have in Britain the distraction of the whole Brexit affair still, and so on. And all of these things are creating a very febrile and a tense environment in which this broader struggle between the United States and China particularly, but in a sense between the West more generally, and China is playing out. And that makes this a very, very high-stakes gamble indeed.
Jonathan Marcus. The European Union's chief Brexit negotiator, Michel Barnier, has warned the British Prime Minister, Boris Johnson, to stick to his promises or face the prospect of not getting a trade deal. In an interview with the Sunday Times newspaper ahead of talks resuming this week, Mr. Barnier also urged the British government to be more realistic in its approach. From Brussels, here's our Europe reporter, Gavin Lee.
There have been three rounds of talks since March. Both sides agree that the last two have been slow, frustrating, and made more difficult by the effects of the pandemic, which has limited talks to video conference rather than face-to-face. In his newspaper interview, Michel Barnier says the UK side has been stepping back from some of the basic written commitments made by the Prime Minister months ago as part of the political declaration signed with the EU Commission. Mr. Barnier warned that there will be no trade deal if Britain broke those terms. The two sides still can't agree on rules around fishing rights, state aid, and who will oversee the terms of the agreement. British officials say the EU is trying to bind the UK to European law and are calling on the bloc's negotiators to rethink their approach during this week's talks if there's to be any chance of a breakthrough.
Gavin Lee. Schools around the world are starting to open up after COVID-19 forced them into lockdown, but there are fears that letting children return to class could result in a surge of new cases. In South Korea, hundreds of schools were forced to close again following a new spike in infections. In the Netherlands, pupils returned to primary schools on the 11th of May, almost 3 weeks ago. Anna Holligan has been to see what the impact has been at one school in North Brabant, one of the country's worst hit regions.
It used to be hopscotch. Today, six-year-olds are crouching on the concrete playground, chalking coronavirus molecules from memory. Little bacteria bugs. That's corona, she tells me. I know it from the news, from my girlfriends, and the teacher, she says. For the pupils at Springboard Primary, going back to school comes with five new rules. Only children and teachers are allowed inside. And outside the gates, there are painted footprints to make sure the parents are aware of the spacing, 1.5 metres, and notes attached to the gates saying halen and brengen, drop off and pick up point. Scrub every time you enter the building. There's a hand sanitizer pump at every entrance. Use shields. A plastic screen goes round each desk. It's designed to reduce the spread of germs. older pupils from age 6 must now stay 1.5 metres away from their teachers. There's yellow tape on the floor. These are lessons they hope will save lives.
When your grandmother died and you cannot be at a funeral, you have a lot of sadness.
Rasha van der Sluis is the technical coordinator here.
They can play with their friends, so they can a little bit forget about the sad times.
For the younger ones, practically nothing's changed. But teachers like Miss Daisy are working behind the scenes.
We must clean everything daily. And children are children, and if one of the children has fallen, I go to it and I'm giving the child comfort, taking them, and they get a hug or something like that. Yes, I think it's very important.
At least 99 Dutch primary school teachers have tested positive for COVID-19 so far this month. They're still monitoring the infection rates. Dr. Patricia Browning-Verhagen is an epidemiologist at the University Medical Center in Utrecht.
Since they opened, we haven't seen an upsurge in the number of cases in the Netherlands. So there has, so far, there has been no effect. And be cautious, but you know, keeping kids from going to school for a very long time, I think that's also very big challenging.
And that report from Anna Holligan. In countries easing their lockdown restrictions, schools like those in the Netherlands are reopening, shops too, and restaurants. Live sport is also being played behind closed doors. But far less certain is the future of live music venues, a key element of a multi-billion dollar industry and often places where up-and-coming bands are nurtured. So, how are artists and venue owners reacting to the current situation? Well, Nick Stewart is the manager of Sneaky Pete's in Edinburgh and the national coordinator of the Music Venues Alliance for Scotland, which represents 800 grassroots venues. Dana Jean Phoenix is a Canadian singer-songwriter who was due to tour Europe this month. James Kumarasamy has been speaking to both of them about the impact the virus is having on live music. Here's Nick first.
What we expect to be the government advice is pretty simple stuff. Try to keep 2 metres distancing between everyone. Try to keep surfaces clean, reduce possibility of contact between people and people and surfaces. But when it sounds pretty simple, in practical terms, it actually is very, very hard to achieve. So a 100 capacity venue like Sneaky Pete's suddenly goes down to 16 capacity, including staff and performers, if you've got 2 metres in between people. And if you double that up, if you get to the WHO standard, which is 1 metre, we're still looking at maximum about 30% of a normal capacity.
Can you survive like that?
We might be able to do it for a while, but across the UK, the music venues are fairly certain that they can't. And we're really aware that we're part of musicians' careers and we care about that. It's one of the real reasons we're there. We simply can't go around booking bands because we can't afford it.
Let's turn to a musician. Dana, you were due to be touring in Europe, I think, this month, weren't you? How have you been affected by the crisis?
Yeah, well, I was looking forward to going on tour this month and the next month as well to promote a new album. That would have been my third time coming to Europe.
So what have you been doing instead?
Using technology to keep in touch with a lot of my collaborators and kind of exchanging ideas.
And in terms of interaction with fans, have you found ways of doing that?
Yeah, absolutely. By way of Facebook and Twitter, Instagram stories and posts, just really trying to keep in contact with the fans and let them know what's happening.
But it's not a live performance.
No, nothing really quite compares to a live performance. That same sort of heightened shared experience, you know, as a performer, it's really about a back and forth exchange of energy with the audience. And so that's certainly going to be reduced with only, you know, as Nick said, 16 people in the venue total.
Are there ways around this? Are there ways of rethinking the live experience, do you think?
Yeah, I think there's a way to perhaps make it feel like these are kind of more special, almost like coffee house type events, and maybe rethinking just sort of the energy that you're putting out there. So the genre of music that I do, synthwave, is very high energy, and it's almost akin to a club event where people are dancing all night. So perhaps maybe having a more stripped down set could work.
And Nick, what impact is it going to have on bands who are starting out, do you think, who use venues like yours to start to gather a bigger audience?
I think you're definitely right about that role the venues play. It's now frequently described as grassroots music venues like mine being the research and development hub of the music industry. But how you get those starts now is going to be really crucial. Live experience is so completely different to anything that you might see as an online reproduction that you might want to do instead of doing live shows. And similarly, you know, if you degrade the quality of performance that you can have, people might go out to venues, but they might go, this isn't great. Clearly, there's a hunger to have the full quality of amazing live shows that we used to be able to present. I think there are circumstances under which we might be able to do it. We're seeing some venues open in China as nightclubs at the moment, for instance. What they're doing in China is they're testing before people go into venues, and they can test or make sure that people don't have COVID-19 before they enter. Now, if we're going to get some of these quicker 15 to 2 minute tests before people go into a venue, then I think we could have something a lot closer to our current shows.
Music venue manager Nick Stewart and the singer-songwriter Dana Jean talking to James Kumarasamy. And we'll stick with the musical theme, albeit on a sad note, to end this edition of the Global News podcast. The celebrated French opera singer Maddy Mesplé has died at her home in Toulouse. She was 89 and had been suffering from Parkinson's disease. Grant Ferret looks back on the career of one of the finest sopranos of our time.
Maddy Mesplé was from a musical family in Toulouse and initially trained as a pianist, but at the local conservatoire it was her voice that gained attention. Although Mesplé herself claimed not to be especially fond of it, she went on to perform leading roles at opera houses worldwide. She made her debut in 1953, singing a part that would largely define her career. She played Lakmé nearly 150 times. But she also embraced modern repertoire, including works by Boulez and Schoenberg. The French culture minister said Maddy Mesplé could interpret any work with accuracy and sensitivity. After 3 decades on stage, she took up teaching and returned to her home in Toulouse.
The voice of Maddy Mesplé, who's died at the age of 89. And that's it from us for now, but there'll be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Valerie Sanderson. Until next time, bye-bye.